or fiscal consolidation. Instead, Athens let its tax revenue decline. The primary surpluses evaporated and the deficit expanded to 5.5%, twice the Maastricht limit. This was bearable only because nominal income growth was so rapid. What made Greece's situation dangerous, however, was not the pace of borrowing after 2001, but the debts built up in the 1980s and 1990s, when modern Greek democracy had been established on the back of a huge surge in government spending and expensive borrowing. In 2000, Greece's debt already amounted to 104% of GDP. Though the degree of Greece's problems was not fully appreciated, it was a known problem case, and it was small fry. More politically significant in the early 2000s was the violation of the Growth and Stability Pact rules by France and Germany. This definitely eroded the authority of fiscal discipline, but what were the economic consequences? There was ample demand in financial markets for German Bunds and France's treasuries, also known as OATs. Interest rates remained low. France maintained a level trade balance. Germany's government ran up debt, but combined it with consumer and investment spending so repressed that it produced an ever larger current account surplus. From the point of view of the Eurozone's macroeconomic balance, it would have been better if Germany had broken the fiscal rules more comprehensively. It may fly in the face of conservative assumptions about democratic deficits and the spendthrift habits of irresponsible politicians, but the formation of the Eurozone without an ironclad fiscal constitution did not lead to a festival of unrestrained sovereign borrowing. The backdrop to the Eurozone crisis was indeed a gigantic surge in debt, but it was in the private, not the public, sector. The Eurozone played host to the same runaway, market-driven process of credit creation that European banks were contributing to so actively in the North Atlantic economy. As the Financial Times economic commentator Martin Sandbill has remarked, it was the Euro's great misfortune to be born into the greatest private credit bubble of all time. To which one might add that it was not entirely a matter of bad luck. Giving Europe the scale necessary to cope with the wild fluctuations of global capital unleashed in the early 1970s was always the chief raison d'etre of the European Monetary Union. But the global credit expansion of the early 2000s put anything hitherto experienced in the shade, and Europe's banks were at the leading edge of the boom. French, German, Italian, Benelux, Spanish, Irish, and British banks poured credit into profitable hot spots of growth. The Eurozone allowed them to do so without regard to borders or currency risk. Cross-border lending within the Eurozone exploded, rising even more rapidly than cross-border finance globally. Europe's bankers used the same array of modern banking techniques in the Eurozone that they were putting to such profitable use in London and New York. Securitization had long been a method of mortgage finance in Europe. Notably in Germany, the Pfandbrief model had been a staple since the 18th century. But from the early 2000s, American-style securitization took off in Europe as well. In 2007, more than $500 billion in loans were securitized in Europe. In 2008, the total reached $750 billion in European asset-backed security issuance, with UK and Spanish banks particularly active. Once again, as in the case of America's international finances, it is easy to deceive oneself about the direction of these intra-European flows. We have a clear map of the economic hierarchy of Europe in our heads. We know where the loans went: Greece, Spain, Ireland. We know that Germany was the main surplus and creditor nation. So does that mean that Germany financed the credit boom? Certainly it had the largest trade surplus and was thus the largest net exporter of capital, but as far as overall financial flows within Europe are concerned, that simple mental map is as misleading as the exclusive focus on Sino-American financial relations is on a global scale. Thanks to the work of economists at the European Commission, we can map the flow of funds within Europe as part of the broader circulation of funds throughout the world economy. If we focus on intra-European flows, it is clear that Germany, despite its export prowess, did not dominate the European financial system. Germany was the largest net lender. Its status was like that of China in relation to the US economy. But financial flows within Europe no more mapped onto trade than they did in the world economy. Germany was a champion exporter of cars and machinery, but in banking and finance, others led the field. The UK, France, the Benelux and Ireland were the key hubs for financial flows. The City of London, home to banks from around the world, including all the leading German banks, stands out as the major financial partner for every Eurozone member, even though it was not a member of the currency union. France and the Benelux were particularly important because they served as channels through which funds flowed into the Eurozone from the outside. American and other lenders from the rest of the world clearly preferred to do business with well-known French, Dutch and Belgian counterparties, who then channeled the funds to the European periphery. France was a major financial hub, not because it had a huge trade surplus, but because it had large, ambitious banks that were willing to borrow to lend. 445 billion euros flowed out of France and 447 billion flowed in, leaving a net imbalance of merely 2 billion euros. At the same time, 602 billion euros flowed out of the Benelux banking centres and 559 billion flowed in. The Dutch trade surplus made up the difference. The flow of funds around Europe, as around the global economy, was driven not by trade flows, but by the business logic of bankers, who sought out the cheapest funding and the best returns. The upward spiral of asset prices and balance sheets that drove the US boom was even more pronounced in Europe. Between 2001 and 2006, Greece, Finland, Sweden, Belgium, Denmark, the UK, France, Ireland, and Spain all experienced real estate booms more severe than those that energized the United States. In Ireland and Spain, the combination of credit growth and house price inflation was truly explosive. It was these credit-fueled booms that drove the trade and fiscal imbalances of the Eurozone rather than the other way around. The huge influx of credit from all over the world to a hotspot like Spain inflated economic activity there. This generated healthy tax revenues for Madrid, which proudly boasted a fiscal surplus. It also generated export orders for Germany. Foreign demand gave a boost to the languishing German economy, raising incomes and profits. But German households and businesses did not want to spend their income increment in Germany on either consumption or investment. The German government borrowed, but not enough to soak up the difference. Through interbank markets, surplus liquidity in the north helped to fund business ventures around Europe. Some of that, not surprisingly, went to Spain. At the end of the day, the accounts balanced. Germany's savings appear as the counterpart to Spain's trade deficit. But accounting identity is not the same as causal relationship. It wasn't Germany's excess savings or its exports that produced the boom in Spain. It was the lopsided credit-fueled boom that produced the demand imbalances, the trade flows and the savings imbalances. Europe's banking system provided elastic intermediation. Had Germany's domestic economy been in more robust shape, Germany's demand for imports would have been larger, and the trade imbalances within the Eurozone might have been smaller. A somewhat larger fraction of the Spanish economy might have been directed toward producing goods for export to Germany, rather than supplying the domestic boom. But there is no reason to think that a smaller flow of net savings from a more rapidly growing Germany would have done much to slow the credit-fueled upswing in Ireland or Spain. In modern finance, credit is not a fixed sum constrained by the fundamentals of the real economy. It is an elastic quantity, which in an asset price boom can easily become self-expanding on a transnational scale. Where does Greece, the country that will become the epicenter of the Eurozone crisis, fit in this picture? It is present, but vanishingly small. Of the annual flux in cross-border funding within the Eurozone between 2004 and 2006, which on average came to around 1.8 trillion euros, Greece accounted for 33 billion euros. That is less than 2%, proportional to Greece's weight in Eurozone GDP. Of that flow of funds, a larger share than was the case in Ireland and Spain went to the Greek state. But Greece too experienced a property boom on a par with the United States. The red flag in Greece was not the annual inflow of capital after 2001, but the fact that the new borrowing was being added to huge stocks of debt already accumulated in prior decades. What would happen if the flow of funds was abruptly cut off was a worrying question. But given Greece's tiny size, it was hardly headline-grabbing. It would later be said that the ECB should have done more to dampen the boom in Ireland and Spain. And it is clearly true that this was made more difficult by the fact that it set one interest rate for the entire Eurozone. In effect, by setting low rates, the ECB prioritized the need to stimulate the German economy over restraining the boom in the periphery. It was a reasonable decision. Germany's economy is far bigger. Furthermore, given the rates of return that beckoned in the hot spots of the European economy, it is wishful thinking to imagine that the ECB could have curbed the boom with a rate hike. If the EU's business statistics are to be believed, investment in Spanish tourism and real estate offered rates of return of 30% or more. Little wonder that investment crowded in. In a world of globalized finance, the ECB could no more limit the flow of funds to such a hot spot than the Fed could choke off the capital inflow to the United States. Ireland's banks were a case in point. They sourced their funding wholesale in the City of London, outside the ECB's immediate purview. To have slowed the booms would have required not a mild tweak of ECB interest rates, but a full-scale economic policy mobilization by the governments of the boom countries. This might have included tougher lending rules throttling back growth in the banking system, and even tighter fiscal policy. In the case of Spain, the larger internationalized banks were, in fact, held on a tight leash. Foreign investors expected high governance standards, and they came through the crisis well. But the same cannot be said for the local mortgage lenders, the cajas, that made up 50% of the credit market. They were tightly connected with local politics and deeply immersed in the real estate boom. Between 2002 and 2009, their business grew by a factor of 2.5, resulting in a combined balance sheet of 483 billion euro, or 40% of Spanish GDP. But efforts to restrict their lending were easily seen as a centralizing power grab by Madrid. And why should Spain's politicians undertake such unpopular action? One of the side effects of a bubble is that it makes balance sheets look good. Tough governance reform seems unnecessary and punitive. Spaniards were enjoying their long overdue return to the spotlight. Firms like Telefónica, Ferrovial, and Banco Santander were emerging as global players. Fashion giant Zara made its owner, Amancio Ortega, the richest billionaire in Europe. Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero was lobbying for Spain to be invited to join the top table in an expanded G8. With lean social services and booming tax revenues, Spain's public budget was in far better shape than that of France or Germany. Why put the brakes on such a healthy-looking burst of private sector growth? Among Ireland's tiny political elite, a similar spirit of ebullience prevailed. Coddled by EU investment and incestuously connected with bankers and developers, politicians boasted of the global attractions of Dublin's International Financial Services Centre. Ireland's tax system enabled foreign corporations to spirit hundreds of billions of dollars in profit past tax authorities in the United States and the rest of Europe. Though a member of the Eurozone and benefiting enormously from Brussels' subsidy payments, the Irish liked to regard themselves as an outpost of American or Anglo-American free market values on the far edge of a continent where various brands of social democracy were still the political norm. In the American presidential election of 2008, the world was treated to the incongruous spectacle of Phil Gramm, chief champion of deregulation in Congress in the 1990s and economic advisor to Republican hopeful John McCain, touting Ireland as the beau ideal of a low-tax economy. Disgraced former Prime Minister Bertie Ahern toured the world selling audiences on the benefits of extreme economic globalization, low personal and corporate taxes, business-friendly government, and light regulation. There are many risks involved in forming a currency union, and it would no doubt have made sense for Europe to have added a fiscal constitution. But Europe's chief problem was not the lack of a fiscal fire code. Its problem was the lack of a financial fire department. The failure of state building that mattered most was not fiscal union, but the failure to build the capacity to handle a banking crisis. Coping with highly integrated financial capitalism requires a state that is disciplined, has the capacity to act, and has the will to do so. Coping with a banking crisis on the scale that was brewing in Europe required a very capable state indeed. How badly such a facility was needed becomes clear only when we put together the local and global activities of Europe's banks to get a full view of their spectacularly overinflated growth. America's banks were very big and very important to global finance, but it was in Europe that bank finance had grown most disproportionately. Europe's banks had always been large. Unlike the United States, where equity and bond markets were the main sources of business finance, Europe's economies had long relied heavily on bank lending. But spreading out across the EU and feeding off the transatlantic financial circuit, the European banks had grown to gargantuan size. In 2007, the three largest banks in the world by assets were all European: RBS, Deutsche Bank, and BNP. Combined, their balance sheets came to 17% of global GDP. The balance sheet of each of them came close to matching the GDP of its home country, Britain, Germany, and France, the three largest economies in the EU. In tiny Ireland, the situation was far more extreme. The liabilities of its banks added up to 700% of GDP. France and the Netherlands rivaled each other with liabilities of 400% of GDP. The banks of Germany and Spain had liabilities amounting to 300% of GDP. By this standard, every member of the Eurozone was at least three times more overbanked than the United States. Furthermore, Europe's banks were far more dependent on volatile, wholesale, market-based funding than their US counterparts. Given the size of the balance sheets and the complexity of Europe's banking businesses, it was foreseeable that only collective action would be sufficient to bail out a crisis that could spread across the Eurozone. To call for unified action to tame, discipline and make safe a particular sector of business activity was hardly out of keeping with Europe's history. Indeed, the origin of European integration was the realization that Europe's coal and steel industries were sources of conflict and instability. Out of that logic had emerged the European Coal and Steel Community as the first step toward the European rescue of a nation-state. Likewise, the Common Agricultural Policy had been devised in the 1960s to contain the spillover costs of national farm support policies. It was only in the 1980s that this sectoral vision of the EU went out of fashion, displaced by the deceptive simplicity of the single market. This was the true deficit of the Eurozone. It was a monetary union that unified financial markets, but provided none of the institutions of governance required for a banking union. If there was one urgent reason why Europe truly did need a fiscal constitution, it was to provide the financial underpinning for a giant deposit insurance and bailout fund. In the late 1990s, as European monetary union approached, Larry Summers had the temerity to ask an international gathering of financial experts, "Could the Europeans here explain to me what happens if a bank in Spain gets into serious trouble? What are the respective responsibilities of the Spanish supervision authorities, the Spanish Central Bank, the ECB, and Brussels?" The question silenced the meeting. After an embarrassed pause, there followed a chaotic argument among the Europeans, which ended without resolution, but with only a sense that they didn't want to air their linen in front of the rest of us. Looking back on the incident, Summers attributed the chaos and embarrassed silence to the usual disunity of European politics. But in truth, it was not that different from the United States. No one in the United States wanted to think about bank failures either, not in 1997 and not in 2007. Indeed, as his reaction to Rajan's impolitic remarks at the Jackson Hole conference in August 2005 made only too clear, Summers was one of the very serious people enforcing that taboo. The state of denial was common. The difference was that when the unthinkable happened, the United States had a structure of federal government within which to improvise a response. The misfortune of the EU was that when the crisis struck, it not only lacked such structures, the crisis came at a moment when the EU's efforts to build a more robust constitutional framework had run up against basic political limits. Up to the early 2000s, the EU operated against a backdrop of what political scientists called a permissive consensus. Europe's population accepted the gradual push for ever closer union without enthusiasm, but also without protest. The EU is not an obtrusive presence. Contrary to prevailing myth, the EU is by no means a gigantic bureaucracy. The EU employs fewer people than most medium-sized cities. But it was a sprawling, incoherent constitutional structure lacking in democratic accountability. It was clearly unsatisfactory, and would become even more so once the EU expanded in 2004 to include new East European members. In December 2001, the European Council charged a European Convention with drafting a constitutional document that would ensure efficiency, clearer lines of responsibility, and prepare the way for Europe's expansion. The convention consisted of a commission of bigwigs headed by that old warhorse of French Europeanism, former President Giscard d'Estaing. The proposal enshrined a new balance between centralized decision-making by majority vote and the irreducible role of the European nation-states. It subordinated all the various institutions and treaties that had made up the pillars of European integration into a single overarching European Union. Europe's ambition was defined as being a social market economy that prioritized full employment, social justice, and solidarity between generations, as well as the fight against social exclusion and discrimination, while also promising to be highly competitive. The Constitution was a pleasing portmanteau of all the nostrums of good governance of the early 2000s. The European trade union movement gave its approval. Tony Blair and Britain's New Labour government were enthusiastic. In Washington, D.C., the Hamilton Project would probably have been pleased to put its name to it. But on May 29, 2005, the Constitution was rejected by popular referenda in France, and then, in June, in the Netherlands. Left-wing hostility to the pro-market character of the EU and nationalist hostility to Brussels united to deliver solid majorities against it. It was a profound shock. The permissive consensus was dead. Whatever the rights and wrongs of the Constitution, popular democracy had asserted itself, and Europe's elite were left in disarray. Given the reality of increasingly close economic and financial integration and the extension of the EU to Eastern Europe, the project of reorganizing Europe could not simply be abandoned. A substitute had to be found. If a true constitution was no longer a viable proposition, Europe would have to proceed by the tried-and-trusted formula of intergovernmental treaty. This gave a key role to Germany, and from November 2005, this meant Chancellor Angela Merkel. Merkel's relationship to Europe was quite different from that of her mentor, Helmut Kohl. Given her upbringing in Cold War East Germany, her early fascination with the outside world was directed first to Russia and then to Britain and the United States. This was of a piece with her embrace of globalism and its causes of the 1990s, including environmental politics and climate change. The unified Germany is what made her. Beyond that, Merkel's world was larger than Europe. The crucial implication is that in European affairs, the German Chancellor did not look to Brussels for solutions. She was no federalist. Rather than seeing the future of Europe in the construction of common European institutions and machinery directed from Brussels, Merkel advocated intergovernmentalism. She looked for grand bargains between the European nation-states. There are those who suspect that this is merely a disguise for a project of German domination. There were nationalists on the fringes of German politics of whom this might truly be said, but Merkel was not one of them. Nor were other key figures in the CDU leadership, such as her interior minister Wolfgang Schäuble, who would, in 2009, replace Steinbrück as finance minister in Merkel's second government. Unlike Merkel, Schäuble was a federalist, eager to move the hard core of Europe to a higher stage of integration. What they shared was not a desire to dominate Europe. There was no grand hegemonic project in early 21st century Berlin. What they had in common was their belief that it is not just Germany's right, but its proper historical role to act as a self-confident veto player in European affairs. Germany's terrible history forbids strategies of domination or even overly assertive leadership, but the success of the Federal Republic gives it the right to insist that European solutions meet its standards, and Berlin will apply those standards as it sees fit. It was a minimal, demanding, and sometimes arbitrary and self-serving posture. The position of Madame Non that Merkel only too readily assumes in European affairs was strongly backed by the domestic electorate. If it was a blind spot, it was not a repressed desire for domination, but a tendency to underestimate the extent to which Germany's success and international prominence were in fact interdependent with Europe. It also arrogated to Germany the right to set the pace. A veto costs time, and in an urgent crisis, whether in financial or foreign affairs, time lost can exact a heavy price. The more acute the crisis, the more decisive is the control over the clock exercised by the veto player. As Europe entered rough waters, it was predictable that both the fear of German domination and calls for German leadership would intensify. So, too, would Berlin's determination to control the pace of events. It was a fateful coincidence that in the wake of the constitutional debacle of 2005, it was Germany that took the rotating presidency of the Council of the EU. At this moment, early on in her career as Chancellor, Merkel assumed responsibility for redrafting and driving through a replacement for the failed constitution. The result, after months of meticulous high-pressure preparation by Berlin, was the Lisbon Treaty of December 2007. Like the constitution it replaced, the Lisbon Treaty merged the multiple pillars of the European integration project into a single European Union with a population of 500 million. It created a new foreign and security policy for the EU. It streamlined the Commission and established the principle of majority voting that was essential to make the vastly expanded structure manageable. But above all, it institutionalized the Council as the representation of Europe's national governments and created a presidency of the Council as its standing representative. It ended any pretension on the part of the European Commission and its president to executive leadership. Many of the key provisions of the original constitutional treaty were thus maintained, but the defeat of 2005 left a lasting mark. The paramountcy of Europe's national governments was reaffirmed. For the foreseeable future, there would be no further steps toward federal integration. Policy in Europe would be made not centrally by Brussels, but by intergovernmental bargain. As the first financial boom of the 21st century began to unravel in 2007, Europe was in a conflicted situation. It was deeply economically integrated, with the ECB presiding from a distance over a hyperactive financial system that linked the Eurozone to the City of London and Wall Street. And yet, the wider politics of European integration were in retreat. The Lisbon Treaty enshrined intergovernmentalism, and Europe's voters had shown their willingness to exercise a veto over steps beyond that. How, given this disequilibrium, the EU would respond to an unforeseen crisis was anyone's guess. And that observation went beyond finance. If one compares American and European policy discussions in the early 2000s, one sees that they shared many preoccupations. Policy experts on both continents were focused on fiscal discipline and international competitiveness, supply-side incentives, efficient government spending, deficits, evidence-based welfare policy, education reform, and flexible labour markets. These were the shibboleths of the watered-down supply-side market economics inherited from the days of Reagan and Thatcher and the Washington Consensus of the 1990s. The policy communities on both sides of the Atlantic also shared blind spots. Sharing a deep faith in markets, neither realized the threat posed by the new market-based model of banking. On both sides of the Atlantic, they were oblivious to the risks accumulating in over-leveraged banks, relying on vast quantities of wholesale funding. Why, then, did both sides find it so hard to recognize the risks that they shared? And why have crisis narratives on either side of the Atlantic diverged so sharply since 2008? If we are looking for one crucial difference, it is surely this. From the morning of September 11, 2001, America was a superpower at war. Not only that, under the Bush administration, it was a regime pursuing a global war on terror. The initial European reaction to the attacks of 9/11 was one of solidarity. The ouster of the Taliban from Kabul enjoyed general support. But over the winter of 2002 to 2003, as Washington and London pushed toward the invasion of Iraq, that sense of common commitment evaporated. The German and French governments came out in opposition to war, as did millions of European citizens who filled the streets in some of the largest demonstrations in Europe's history. This was the moment in which the American neoconservative Robert Kagan coined his famous phrase that Americans were from Mars and Europeans from Venus. Europe's leading intellectuals responded in kind. The unlikely pairing of Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida issued a counterblast. Significantly for them, the transatlantic divide went far beyond foreign policy. It extended to social policy and political culture. In the early 21st century, it amounted to nothing less than a civilization divide, a bifurcation within modernity between the chastened post-imperial world of Europe and the expansive, imperially aggressive Anglosphere. A wide gulf conventionally separates accounts of global geopolitics in the wake of 9/11 from our narratives of the genesis of the financial crisis. But if we listen closely, it is clear that the quagmire of Iraq haunted the Washington policymaking elite in the early 2000s, awakening nightmarish memories of Vietnam and the crisis of American power and authority of the 1930s. The rise of China added to the sense of menace. Larry Summers's description of the Sino-American trade balance as a balance of financial terror was telling. That was not how the Germans or the Dutch thought about their trade surpluses. The pervasive militarization of the language of national leadership in the United States would become even more glaring once the crisis began. Both in rhetoric and self-conception, it would mark a fundamental transatlantic divide. In terms of political culture, the differences are undeniable. But to take the loudly proclaimed transatlantic alienation of the early 2000s at face value as a description of economic or geopolitical reality would be self-deceiving in a double sense. The idea that social Europe had deviated in any essential way from the logic of turbocharged financial capitalism as exemplified by America was an illusion. In fact, Europe's financial capitalism was even more spectacularly overgrown, and it owed a large part of its growth to its deep entanglement in the American boom. Furthermore, whatever the differences over Iraq, Europe's pose of geopolitical innocence is a historically recent phenomenon. Though it balked at Iraq, France remains a hardened post-colonial war fighter. nor does Europe only do small wars. As recently as the 1980s, the European members of NATO had been active participants in winning the Cold War and making the victory stick. Given the dramatic escalation of tension with the Soviet Union, the stakes could hardly have been higher. Particularly notable was the Federal Republic's commitment to hard power. At its peak, the Bundeswehr had a standing strength of 500,000, with a mobilization strength of 1.3 million. The deployment of nuclear-armed cruise and Pershing missiles to Europe in 1983 was a transatlantic effort that bonded a generation of Atlanticists in the face of concerted opposition from the left in both Europe and the United States. The high priests of Europe's 21st century cult of innocence reside, of course, in Brussels. But though the EU might prefer to deny the fact, in the post-Cold War world it was far from geopolitically inert. It entertained complex relations with its neighbours in the Mediterranean and in Eastern Europe that could not easily be disentangled from the hard power of the NATO alliance or coercive border policing. And this would matter. Because whereas the EU kept its distance from the Middle East imbroglio and refused to see the rise of China as a geopolitical threat, it would be on Europe's doorstep that a violent, great power confrontation would erupt, and it did so just as the world banking system began to unravel. In August 2008, as the financial markets hurtled toward disaster, Russia went to war with Georgia, a Western-backed proxy.
Chapter 5. Multipolar World. Russia's return to the world stage in the early 2000s owed even more to global economic growth than did the rise of China. Russia poured oil and gas into world markets. Its banks and industrial corporations borrowed enthusiastically in Europe and the United States. Like China, it held a huge reserve of dollars, but unlike China, its financial and economic interrelationship with the United States was indirect. Russia did not earn its dollars by exporting to the United States. It sold its gas and oil to Europe and Asia. Furthermore, whereas the Chinese Communist Party approached the West with self-confidence, the wounds of the Soviet Union's defeat in the Cold War were still fresh. There were no fond memories of a Nixon-Kissinger moment in the Kremlin. It was not by accident, therefore, that it would be Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, the Cold War KGB operative, who would pose the question that China and America preferred not to speak out loud. What, Putin demanded to know, were the implications of a rebalanced and reintegrated world economy for the geopolitical order? Putin not only posed the question. In so doing, he exposed a deep lack of agreement within the West, inside Europe, and between Europe and the United States, over what kind of international architecture should frame economic and financial development, not just in the world at large, but in particular on Europe's very doorstep, in Eastern Europe, the showcase for capitalist transition in the post-Cold War world. In Europe, unlike in Asia, the triumph of the West over communism was absolute. It was a triumph of both hard and soft power, military, political, and economic might. Though Germans might give more credit to Gorbachev and détente diplomacy, and Americans more to Reagan and Star Wars, the Atlantic Alliance was united in victory. No one benefited more from the end of the Cold War than a newly reunified Germany, and it was German-American cooperation that secured the win. In 1990, French President François Mitterrand favoured a conciliatory vision of embracing the former Soviet bloc in a common European security policy that would supersede NATO as well as the Warsaw Pact. But neither Helmut Kohl nor George Bush wanted anything to do with that. The West had won. It would set the terms for Europe's reunification. The fall of the wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union in December 1991 left Russia shrunken and isolated. Not since the dark days of Lenin's ruinous peace of Brest-Litovsk in 1918 had Russia been so humbled. Under Yeltsin, Moscow's relations with the West were friendly, but Russia's economy was a shipwreck. In the words of George Soros, Russia was a centrally planned economy with the centre knocked out. In the so-called transitional recession, inflation soared, and Russia's real GDP fell by 40% between 1989 and 1995. On Black Tuesday, October 11, 1994, in one single session of frantic currency trading, the ruble lost more than a quarter of its value against the dollar. It was not until 1995 that Russia's economy stabilized. A modest revival fueled by large imports of foreign capital enabled Russia to catch its breath, only to be thrown off balance yet again by the Asian financial crisis of 1997. Struggling to hold the exchange rate, the Russian Central Bank introduced exchange controls and begged an emergency IMF loan. But in August 1998, Yeltsin's government lost its grip. On August 17th, Moscow devalued and declared a 90-day moratorium on the payment of foreign debts owed by Russian banks. The ruble went into freefall, plunging from 7 to the dollar to 21. The cost of imports surged. Russians who had borrowed abroad faced bankruptcy. Then, on August 19th, the Russian government defaulted on its ruble-denominated domestic debts. By October 1998, with 40% of the population counted as living below the subsistence minimum, Moscow was reduced to appealing to the international community for assistance to pay for food imports. As inflation soared to an annualized rate of 84%, Russians lost confidence in their national currency. As the new millennium began, dollars made up 87% of the value of all currency in circulation in Russia. Outside the United States, Russia was the largest dollar economy in the world. International investors in Russia were required to pay their local taxes in American currency. Russia became the ultimate experiment in dollarization, a nuclear-armed former superpower with a currency supplied from Washington. With the exception of newly independent Ukraine, Russia was the worst hit of the post-Soviet countries. But the early 1990s were tough across the former Eastern Bloc. As they stripped away the institutional structure of planning, the economies of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union experienced economic trauma. On average, between 1989 and 1984, output fell by more than 30%. Inflation, unemployment, and social inequality rocketed as real wages plunged and communist-era welfare systems disintegrated. In the Baltic states, the hit to the wage level in the 1990s was staggering. Wages fell by 60% in Estonia and 70% in Lithuania. For many millions, emigration was the best option. Illegal if need be. This was the backdrop against which NATO and the EU decided on enlargement to the east, stabilizing the immediate crisis, offering a future direction and permanently redrawing the geopolitical map. The double expansion of EU and NATO was not a coordinated affair. It was driven as much by the East Europeans themselves as by Washington, Berlin, and Paris. Poland, Hungary, the Czechs, and the Slovaks, the Visegrad Group, began pushing for NATO membership as early as February 1991. The EU followed up with an association agreement. But the EU's decision for enlargement did not follow until 1993, with its conditions being spelled out in detail only in 1997. While some outside observers called for a Marshall Plan to launch economic development, what the EU offered to aspirant members in Eastern Europe was technical and expert assistance as they embarked on the transformation of everything from public finances to transport infrastructure, property rights, and the legal system. Focusing only on the military dimension, NATO could move more quickly. Already in 1999, the Poles, Hungarians, and Czechs were admitted as full members. The really big bang came in 2004. On April 1, 2004, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Romania joined NATO. A month later, all but Bulgaria and Romania also joined the EU. The two stragglers were judged ready for EU membership in 2007. It took 15 years from the end of the Cold War. There were second thoughts in Washington, and many West European governments were reluctant to embark on the eastward expansion. The costs were likely to be huge. The risk of provoking Russia was obvious. In 2003, the divisions over the invasion of Iraq were deep and embarrassing. The East Europeans, who were candidates for both NATO and EU membership, had to choose. On one side stood Berlin and Paris, in opposition to the war. On the other side were Washington, London, and their supporters in Madrid and Rome. Eastern Europe opted overwhelmingly for war, and U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld did not hesitate to rub salt in the wounds, playing the New Europe against the old, leaving France and Germany resentful and isolated. Habermas and Derrida's 2003 vision of a distinct European identity was directed as much against the East Europeans as it was against the Anglo-Americans. It was core Western Europe that counted. It was left to the European Commission to put a brave face on things. Commission President Romano Prodi was fond of announcing that the fall of the wall in 1989 and the reunification of Germany and Europe marked not the end of history, but a new beginning. Whereas Europe's history had once meant conflict and penury, now Europe had nothing to fear, and the world had nothing to fear from Europe. The EU had overcome both the classic power politics of the 19th century and the armed truce of the Cold War. As a bringer of stability, prosperity, and the rule of law, the EU was realizing Kant's dream of perpetual peace. Prodi talked as though the EU would soon emerge as a fully featured state, combining both soft and hard power. But, in fact, the geopolitical configuration of the post-Cold War world was more uncertain and ramshackle than that. The EU never developed its own hard power capabilities. Not only was European military cooperation factious and frowned upon by Washington, but the European states all took the peace dividend. In light of Russia's weakness, what reason was there not to run down their substantial Cold War military establishments? It was this decision that laid the basis for the transatlantic divide on security policy in the 2000s. It also left the East Europeans all the more dependent on the Americans, whose military preponderance grew ever more massive as the new century progressed. At the same time, after the first round of financial assistance in the early 1990s, the United States played no more than a peripheral role in shaping the wider integration of Eastern Europe. On the ground, it was the EU that set the pace in erasing the legacy of the Soviet experiment. The incorporation of Eastern Europe into the EU and NATO was an encompassing geopolitical, political, and bureaucratic process. But the first mover was not officialdom, but West European business. With wages less than one quarter of those prevailing in Germany in the 1990s, the attraction of the highly skilled East European labor force was irresistible. The process of integration was even more dramatic than that taking place among Canada, the United States, and Mexico under the NAFTA agreement. Within a decade of the fall of communism, around half of all East European manufacturing capacity was in the hands of European multinationals. East European motor vehicle production, which soon accounted for 15% of European output, was 90% foreign-owned, with VW's acquisition of Škoda as the emblematic case. Meanwhile, the biggest single foreign investor in Poland in the 1990s was Fiat, followed by Korea's Daewoo. If private capital led the way, it was followed by a rising tide of public funding. All over Eastern Europe, highways and public buildings were emblazoned with a blue badge of the EU and its ring of stars. Though the initial levels of spending were quite modest, after 2000, through the Cohesion Fund, the European Regional Development Fund, and the EU's agricultural subsidy schemes, tens of billions of euros flowed from west to east. In the last funding period, 2007 to 2013, 175 billion euros were earmarked in structural funds for Eastern Europe, 67 billion euros for Poland alone. The Czechs received 26.7 billion euros, and 25.3 billion went to the Hungarians. Across the region, the EU's money was sufficient to fund between 7 and 17% of gross fixed capital formation over a seven-year period. The sums that were poured into the new member states in Eastern Europe by Brussels were comparable in scale to the famous Marshall Plan, launched in 1947 to rescue ruined post-war Western Europe.
whereas after World War II it took until the late 1950s before private capital began to flow abundantly across the Atlantic, in the transition economies of Eastern Europe, the impact of the EU's public funding was immediately multiplied by private investment. The takeover of Eastern Europe's industrial base in the 1990s was just the beginning. By the end of 2008, Western-owned banks in the post-Soviet economies had extended $1.3 trillion in credits. These huge figures were not only the result of foreign loans, but amounted to the wholesale incorporation of the local banking system. Whereas in the Eurozone, French, Dutch, British, and Belgian banks channeled funds into hotspots like Ireland and Spain, in the former communist world, it was Dutch banks like ING, Bavaria's Bayerische Landesbank, the Austrian Raiffeisen Bank, or Italy's UniCredit that took the lead. Across Eastern Europe, financial integration went all the way down. To an extraordinary extent, foreign currency loans were used to finance mortgages, credit cards, and car loans. In Hungary, the most extreme case, between 2003 and 2008, the entire 130% increase in household debt was made up of foreign currency credit. What could signify your arrival in the West more clearly and in a more personal way than the fact that your newly privatized home was financed in Swiss francs? The impact of this simultaneous financial, political, and diplomatic incorporation was transformative. In the main cities of Eastern Europe, the material standard of living converged rapidly with norms in the West. And it is hardly surprising that this should have made an impression on the less favored ex-Soviet republics farther to the east. By the early 2000s, many of the former Soviet republics seemed locked in a time warp. As Gorbachev's foreign minister, Eduard Shevardnadze had been a darling of the West. By the early 2000s, his personal regime in Georgia was so riddled with corruption that it could not borrow even from the IMF. Ukraine had suffered almost as badly as Russia in the economic collapse of the 1990s and showed little sign of recovering. The contrast to its Polish neighbor was painful. The color revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine in 2003 and 2004 were driven, above all, by the determination not to fall further behind and miss out on the dramatic changes going on farther west. The title of the main Ukrainian protest group, PORA, translates as "It's Time." Its symbol was a ticking clock. The post-Soviet laggards had no more time to lose. In Ukraine, the revolutionaries of 2004 were careful to preserve a geopolitical balance, opting for neither Russia nor the West. In Georgia, things were simpler. Having turfed Shevardnadze out, by 2006, the new Western-backed government in Georgia, headed by Mikhail Saakashvili, was glorying in its new status as top reformer accredited by the World Bank. Georgian soldiers were soon on their way to support the coalition in Iraq. Brussels might profess that the EU does not do geopolitics, and that slogan suited policymakers in old Europe, particularly Berlin. But to the bevy of new accession states that joined both NATO and the EU between 1999 and 2007, this made little sense. European integration and NATO were born together in the Cold War. Their joint eastward expansion since 1989 was the result of the defeat of the Soviet Union. As far as the new accession states were concerned, the historical logic linking the EU to NATO, and thus to the United States, was undeniable. Western integration promised security and prosperity, but it also harbored risks, both financial and geopolitical. In the financial integration of Eastern Europe, as across the emerging market economies, the currency question was paramount. There was no uniformity of currency regime in the former communist countries. In the Baltics, Latvia opted for a straight peg against the euro, managed and defended by the central bank. Lithuania and Estonia opted for currency boards, under which the entire domestic monetary system was tied to the stock of euros held by the board. The Poles and the Czechs opted for free floats. Hungary allowed the forint to move within bands, Bulgaria adopted a currency board and Romania a managed float, under which the central bank intervened periodically to guide the movement of the foreign exchange markets within adjustable bands. What they had in common were the optimistic expectation of convergence with the EU and, in due course, Eurozone membership. And these hopes were not merely paper dreams. The preemptive adaptation of Eastern Europe economies to EU conditions changed their way of doing business, how markets operated and who owned what. No less significant was the adaptation of their policy-making institutions and their cadres. Thanks to active involvement by the Bank of England and the ECB, the Eastern European states were, by the early 21st century, equipped with westernized central banks staffed by professional economists. No one was more enthusiastic about the prospect of Eurozone accession than the central bankers. Alignment with Brussels and Frankfurt not only raised their status, it also shielded them against unwanted domestic political pressure. Soon, they would be joining the global elite of central bankers. The result was that Eastern Europe reproduced on Europe's doorstep the configuration of over-optimistic expansion that had led to the emerging market crises of the 1990s. Success stories of market reform and privatization, combined with freedom of capital movement and relative stability of exchange rates, led to a huge inward surge of capital. Capital inflow led to upward pressure on exchange rates. All the indicators looked good. But the entire constellation, the booming domestic economy, the appreciating exchange rate, the rising reserves, could all be traced back to a common factor, the huge inward surge of foreign capital. What if that surge reversed? What if there was a sudden stop? Under top-secret conditions, the IMF ran a simulation exercise in February 2007, role-playing its response to a reversal in Hungary, which was among the most exposed East European economies. So anxious were they to preserve secrecy and avoid a panic that the IMF's IT department created a separate simulation mail email system to avoid notes from the game leaking to the outside. Hungary's own central bank duplicated the simulation. Its results, it breezily informed a conference at the ECB in the summer of 2007, were reassuring. If there was one note of caution, it was a reminder that 60% of Hungary's banking sector was in the hands of Belgian, Austrian, Italian, and German banks. In the event of a crisis, if Budapest was to cope, it would need the closest possible cooperation from its West European counterparts. Hungary's situation was grossly unbalanced, but the situation in the Baltic states was even more extreme. In early 2008, the IMF noted that Latvia's economy was overheating so badly that its imports exceeded its exports by an amount equivalent to 20% of GDP. According to the IMF's models, its currency was overvalued by between 17 and 37%. While China and the United States were in deadlock over their trade imbalances, the IMF's staff thought it might be less contentious to single out Latvia as a country with an undeniably fundamental imbalance. That turned out to be a miscalculation. Any public pronouncement on irrational exuberance in the Baltic was blocked by the Europeans on the IMF board. They wanted to keep the Baltics on track for Euro membership and did not want to risk an IMF warning unleashing a chain reaction of uncertainty across Eastern Europe. The Swedes in particular were deeply concerned. Their banks had lent so heavily to Latvia that a crisis could easily spill back across the Baltic. Over the winter of 2007 to 2008, the Scandinavian representative on the IMF board went so far as to block the dispatch of the IMF delegation to Riga to complete Latvia's regular Article 4 report. No one in Europe wanted to burst the bubble. Latvia was enjoying a recovery from the doldrums of the 1990s. In the fall of 2007, its foreign ministry moved into the newly renovated building it had last occupied in the 1930s, when Latvia first enjoyed its independence from Tsarist Russia. As one retrospective commentator noted, there were high hopes that Latvia would be able to extend its foreign policy presence beyond the transatlantic space and facilitate the development of closer ties between post-Soviet states such as Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova, and the EU and NATO. It was estimated that Latvia's development cooperation budget would grow rapidly, that Latvia would open new embassies in faraway places, and that entering Africa in order to help poorer nations to develop was only a matter of time. To say that this was a transformation in the fortunes of tiny Latvia would be an understatement. It was a vision both expansive and fragile. It depended on two crucial conditions, the continuation of Latvia's feverish economic boom and the acquiescence of its hulking neighbor to the east. Russia had watched as Latvia reclaimed its independence in May 1990. It had watched as Latvia conducted a referendum on EU membership in the autumn of 2003 that overrode the no vote of the ethnic Russian minority. And it had watched as Latvia, along with its Baltic neighbours, joined NATO in April 2004. Would Russia continue to watch as Latvia and other countries like it set about rolling back the Soviet-era boundaries of power even farther to the east? If the 1990s had been terrible for Russia's economy, the new millennium brought a period of recovery. Vladimir Putin, who was confirmed as president by a landslide election victory in May 2000, will forever claim credit for Russia's restoration. In fact, the turnaround in Russia's financial fortunes already had been initiated in 1999 by austere former communist Yevgeny Primakov, Putin's political mentor. The collapse in the external value of the ruble jolted Russia's export industries into life and curbed imports. But the key driver of the recovery was the global boom in oil and other commodities, which began months after Putin took office in the latter half of 2000. From $9.57 per barrel in 1998, the spot price of Urals crude would soar by 2008 to $94 per barrel. It would have taken catastrophic mismanagement for the Russian economy and Russian public finances not to have flourished. The questions were, who would benefit from the boom, and how would it affect Russia's relationship with the outside world? Whereas in the 1990s, large parts of Russia's economy had been privatized, under Putin, the energy sector was brought back under the control of the state, which in effect meant the oligarchic group around the president. In the energy sector, the corporate giants Gazprom and Rosneft were the battering ram of state industry. In October 2003, respectable opinion in the West looked on aghast as Mikhail B. Khodorkovsky, who in the 1990s had installed himself as the billionaire owner of private oil giant Yukos in a particularly egregious privatization deal, was arrested and imprisoned on charges of tax evasion. A year later, Yukos's main assets were snapped up in a fire sale by a shell company that turned out to be a front for state-owned Rosneft. Meanwhile, Gazprom consolidated its grip on the giant gas industry by buying up Sibneft from Roman Abramovich, who retired out of harm's way to London to enjoy life at the top of the Premier League as owner of Chelsea FC. In 2006, threats of prosecution forced Anglo-Dutch oil major Shell to sell its valuable Sakhalin assets to Gazprom. In 2007, the TNK-BP joint venture was leveraged out of another promising gas field. Though Rosneft and Gazprom were never merged, together they gave the Russian state a powerful corporate